I'm the Gypsy, and you're not, and this is the Rubber Biscuit Road Show, presented by Artist Alley Studio, featuring the artisan, handcrafted, and branded creations of the Gypsy and Mad Hatter at www.artistalleystudio.com. And now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 13 of the Rubber Biscuit Roadshow. I am your host, the Gypsy. Well, if you were with us last week, you found out about a very special Christmas that took place for me and my family back in 1969 when Santa Claus paid us a visit. This week on the Rubber Biscuit Roadshow, we return to Never Say Never, an epic journey, volume 1. We are going to take a trip not only back in time, but also to the present. Present being, for this story, July 24th, of 2013, just 2 days before I'm going to bury my mother at Rochester Cemetery in Topeka. You will also find out why we need no wire hangers ever. Wednesday, July 24th, 2013. There are times as we move through life that we are made to feel our age. We never want to feel as if we are growing older, but growing older we do. We make every effort to ignore the fact until one day we are forced to accept and embrace that fact. This apparently had been preordained as my day to accept and reconcile myself to that inescapable fact. I have grown older and the world has moved on. As I entered the Capital City Bank to get change for the parking meter, I looked around the lobby. What a change had come to this classic Tudor-style brick building. My last visit to this building had been when I was 9 years old and it was still a bus station. We, my mother, sister, and I, were taking a trip to Kansas City, Missouri to see the Christmas lights at the Country Club Plaza. Mom loved the lights, and she had tried to make it a Christmas tradition to make the 60-mile journey every year to see the annual spectacle. I can still remember standing in the gift shop picking out two comic books for the trip. One comic featured a cartoon version of comedian Jerry Lewis, and the other was about a rotund, nearsighted superhero named Herbie. Herbie dressed in red long johns, bath towel for a cape, and wore a plunger on his head. His superpower was the ability to float through the air while eating a turkey drumstick. Ah, those classic comics. Mom busied herself picking out a new romance novel. What she saw in that type of pulp fiction, I never understood. My sister, who was 3 at the time, and did what she always did when made to wait for something to happen, she whined. It was her superpower. With that whine, she could make the nastiest supervillain drop to his knees, holding his head in pain and pleading for her to stop. The only thing my sister was missing was a pink tutu, gunny sack cape, and an Easter basket for her head to complete her superhero costume. As I walked up to the bank teller, I smiled. Good afternoon. I was wondering if I could get a couple of dollars change for the parking meter. The teller returned my smile and said, yes, sir. I handed her the 2 sawbucks, and while I waited for her to count out the change, I remarked on how different the building looked from when it had once been a Greyhound bus terminal. The teller looked at me with a quizzical look on her face and said, this was a bus station? I could hear someone outside laughing as I looked at the teller, trying to determine if she was joking. She wasn't, so I explained. After hearing my story of the bus terminal, she said, you're kidding, right? The unseen person that had laughed now confirmed my story. Yes, the disembodied voice said. It was a bus station for years before it was closed. The teller handed me my change and said, it doesn't look like a bus station. I said, that's because it's a bank now. I heard the invisible person laugh again as I took my change, thanked the teller, and headed out the door. As I walked across the street to feed the parking meter, I shook my head in disbelief. I would not have been so shocked by the bank teller's lack of knowledge of the previous use of the building if she had been a 20-something digital age airhead, but she wasn't. She was a 40-something mature woman and old enough to know what the building had once been, and that was when it hit me. If the bank teller is just 40 years old, that makes me 16 years older than her. I am old enough to, theoretically, be her father. Oh my God, when did I get old? I fed the coins into the horizontal, voracious mouth of the steel-gray monster that guarded that sacred asphalt on which my steed rested. I walked away knowing that if I failed to feed this one-eyed sentry on a regular basis, that I would find my steed tagged and held captive for a hefty ransom by the monster's master, a nasty and vicious troll who roamed its domain on a magical horseless chariot and whose weapon of choice was an enchanted box which spit out undefeatable pieces of paper. Opened the door to Oddfellow's fine books and collectibles and found myself instantly transported to a shop in downtown Topeka in the 1930s. The scent of musty tomes and volumes assailed my nose and generated within me the same sense of euphoria I had experienced the day before when I had entered the Topeka Shawnee County Library. The aroma of the wood pulp, that is, the body of the book, is one of the most invigorating smells in the world. It is a scent that holds the promise of mystery, laughter, tears, and knowledge. Adventure and horror contained within the aroma of the press pages, and more than a million dreams wafted their fumes into the nostrils of the human brave enough to explore what lies between the covers of each enticing volume. I am not a bibliophile, but I am a fan and appreciator of the written word. No word ever written or read upon a digital screen can ever hope to replace or capture the essence of sheer feeling of holding a book within your hands and turning to a page. The proprietor of the Grand Wizard of this magical dungeon is Brandon Ryson. He is a gregarious man, broad of face and broad of smile. Brandon is a studious listener and knows within a twinkling of an eye where each and every volume within his domain rests. I was here to meet his dedicated shop owner and his queen, Marty. I had become acquainted with Brandon and Marty through the Facebook group Topeka History Geeks. I was one of the original members of this group, having been referred to by my friend D. Poe, who is also a native Topekan and who knows that I am a history buff, especially when it comes to my hometown. I have been looking forward to a face-to-face meeting with these two people that love Topeka as much as I do. Marty was at work, but Brandon informed me that I would be able to meet her on Thursday evening when she would be in the store to host a Twitter meet and greet. I made a mental note to return on Thursday, but in the meantime I would enjoy a brief visit with Brandon. As Brandon and I spoke, I looked down into the glass display case I was leaning on. It held several vintage comic books, many of which I recognized as I had once had them in my own collection. I remarked to Brandon, "I sure do miss those books. I had each and every one of them once upon a time. Got them cheaply at a bookstore that was once a block east of here." Brandon grinned. "Yeah," he said, "I know who you mean. I would like to take his wax pencil and shove it up his..." He devalued a lot of comics by marking his price on the covers. I laughed. "Yeah, I had a few of those." Brandon pointed out a book in the upper right-hand corner of the case. "That one," he began, "is the first appearance of the Scarecrow." I finished. "There was one in the Golden Age," he said. "But this is the one from the Silver Age," I concluded. "It is fun to meet a fellow geek." I told him that I had also had the first appearance of the Riddler, as well as two irreplaceable comics that I had found for only a nickel in the used comic bin of the aforementioned bookstore. "What happened to your collection, and what were those two irreplaceable comics?" Brandon asked. Shirley was excited. James was coming home today. She would never call him Jimmy again. Her boy was a man, and he was coming home. He would be James to her from here on. Shirley had spent the last week getting the little house in western Missouri ready for his return. She had cleaned it up from top to bottom, even giving his room an extra going over. Shirley had never been a great housekeeper. Her mom was a great housekeeper, managing a full-time job, three meals a day, volunteer work, and church duties. Shirley had never understood how her mom had handled all that. It was all she could do to handle just the normal day-to-day challenges of living. Shirley looked up at the clock. Almost 3. James should be here by 4. A good neighbor, Eddie Pepper, had headed down to KCI to get James from the airport. James had been gone 6 months, and Shirley wondered how much he had grown. She was so proud of him. At 17 years old, even before finishing high school, James had got a scholarship from the USDA to study forestry and wildlife management. He would be stationed at the Forestry Service Camp in Nemo, South Dakota, and on off-duty hours he would finish his high school credits and take college extension classes at the nearby Job Corps campus. 2 weeks back, James had called and told Shirley he wasn't sure he wanted to continue with the scholarship. "It's a lonely life, Mom," he had said. "When you are not on the watchtower, you are trying to control a fire that some fool started. I'm tired of inhaling smoke and still trying to maintain my grades." Shirley, even though she missed James greatly, had tried to talk him out of coming home, but he was adamant. "Mom, I love being outdoors, and I love it in South Dakota. I just don't think I am ready for everything that involves at this time. I want to come home in time to start my junior year there at West Platte High." Shirley had said she understood, and now James would be back home in just a few minutes. Shirley lifted the lid on the crock pot and inhaled a lungful of the slow cooking pot roast. It was James' favorite meal, and though Shirley could barely afford it with most of the food in the house being commodities, she had splurged on the roast, potatoes, and carrots for his homecoming dinner. Patty ran into the house. "Mommy, I see them coming down the street!" Shirley wiped her hands on a towel and hurried to the front of the house. Just as she pushed the screen door open to step out onto the tiny concrete porch, Eddie pulled his small yellow Datsun station wagon in the driveway, and there in the passenger seat was her son, James. Shirley ran out and grabbed him as he was getting out of the car. Giving him a big bear hug, she sobbed, "I missed you, son." He pulled out of her grip, his cheeks slightly red. "I miss you too, Mom. It's good to be home." Shirley grabbed him again and gave him another hug. "I love you, James," she said as she gave him a big kiss on the cheek. He extracted himself from her grip again. "I love you too, Mom. Want to help me get my bags out of Eddie's car?" Shirley started to move towards the back of Eddie's car to help with James's luggage, but Eddie was already unloading it. "I got it," he said with a grin. Eddie Pepper was a tall, lanky Vietnam vet. A retired Navy SEAL combat instructor, his hippie-like long sandy hair and bushy beard were in sharp contrast to his cold steel gray eyes. Quick with a laugh and quicker with his fists, the heavy suitcases were no problem for him. James carried one of his suitcases up the steep stairs off the kitchen up to his bedroom, with Eddie and his mother following with the other two suitcases. James and Shirley thanked Eddie for his help, and Shirley tried to hand Eddie $2 for his trouble. "Put your money away, Shirley. It was my pleasure." Shirley didn't argue. Every penny was precious in his home. That was another reason she was so glad that James was home. She knew that he would go back to work in the tobacco fields and off school hours, helping to offset the household expenses. "Hey, bud," Eddie said to James, "don't forget that game of pool you owe me." James laughed. "I'll just embarrass you." Eddie said his goodbyes and left.
"I'm so glad you two hit it off," Shirley said. "I was hoping you would."
Shirley had always tried to see that James had a man's influence in his life since he had basically grown up without a father. Shirley had met Eddie and his wife Sherry after James had left for South Dakota when Sherry had responded to an ad Shirley had placed in the paper for a babysitter for Patty while she worked. James looked around the room. "The room looks cleaner than when I left it," he said. Shirley beamed.
"I've been cleaning."
James smiled. He knew that his mother was not a good housekeeper and knew that this could be classified as a major accomplishment for her. James never understood his mother's aversion to picking up after herself. His sister had apparently inherited the same gene that dwelled within his mother, so he had always been the one to try and keep the house clean. "Looks good," James said as he headed for his closet to get some hangers for his clothes. Shirley was opening his suitcases as James opened the closet door. Looking down at the floor of the closet, he said, "Mom, where's the big box that I had in the closet?" Shirley looked at him quizzically.
"What box?"
James, feeling his anxiety level starting to rise, said, "The one with all my comic books in it?" Shirley smiled, her face lighting up with pride.
"Oh, that box! I burnt them!"
James had to shake his head to make sure he had just heard her right. With as much patience as he could muster, he said, "Excuse me? You burnt my comics?" Shirley, oblivious to James' anxiety and rising anger, said,
"Of course I did. You are a man now, and you don't need childish things like comics."
In a state of shock and desperately trying to control his anger, James crossed the room and sat down hard on the edge of his bed. Feeling sick to his stomach, he said through gritted teeth, "Mom, those comics were very valuable, especially two of them. I was saving them as a future investment for my retirement fund someday." Shirley thought James was talking nonsense.
"Comics are not valuable. They're comics. Don't be silly. You can't invest them. How much could a comic be worth?"
James cleared his throat and fixed his mother with a stare that told his mother he was very upset and very agitated as he said,
"The two you burnt are two of the rarest, most collectible, and most valuable comics in the world. Both books were not mint, but were in very good condition. Both books just sold at auction for a price well above their cover price."
Shirley was getting upset. This was not how she had envisioned James' homecoming. They were supposed to be happy and celebrating. She could not imagine why he would be upset over her getting rid of his childish things now that he was a man.
"Okay, so what were these oh-so-valuable comics you are so upset about, and how much are they worth? $5? $10?
James looked at her and swallowed the rising gorge from his stomach back down.
This was not how his homecoming was supposed to be. They should be happy and celebrating, but he knew that what he was about to tell her, she would never believe. He also knew that somehow he would have to get his mother to understand what she had done, and he knew that it would be an almost insurmountable task. James stood up and walked across the room and looked into the closet. In the back of his mind, he had hoped that he had just misseen the box. He said a prayer that his mother had pulled some sort of sick practical joke and that the box with the comics was still there. It was not. James turned and looked at his mother sitting on the edge of his bed, looking at him uncomprehending. How was he going to get her to understand the consequences of her action? She never understood. How was James going to explain that it wasn't the monetary value of the comic books, though that was considerable and important? It was something more than money, something that no value could be placed upon. His mother had acted on impulse, just as she always did, and just like always, the consequences of her impulsive actions had dire consequences. The comics were James' last physical connection he had to his home, his beloved Topeka, and now his mother had ripped that connection from him just as severely as she had 2 years before ripped his home from him. Jimmy had just finished reading his newest Batman comic and slid it into the protective sleeve. Jimmy had been a Batman fan since he was 6 years old. He had purchased his first Batman comic the day his mother had given him 50 cents and told him to go to the store and pick out some comic books to read on their bus trip to Kansas City to see the Christmas lights at the Country Club Plaza. He had purchased a 52-page Superman Spectacular for 25 cents, a Batman and Detective comic for a dime each, leaving Jimmy with 5 cents for 3 pieces of bubblegum and 2 pixie sticks. Within the first 2 pages of the Batman comic, Jimmy was hooked, and now 9 years later, he had a sizable collection of comics. Shirley did not have enough extra money to give Jimmy an allowance, so he added to the comic book collection by combing alleys and trash cans for pop bottles that he could return to the store for a nickel each. Money received at Christmas and on his birthday got him a plethora of comic book delight. As Jimmy placed the precious comic into its big bag of comics, he heard his mother pull into the driveway of their small home on Southwest 29th by Shunganunga Creek. He heard the door of the old Rambler open and close. Looking at the clock, he realized his mother was home from work early. As Shirley entered the house, Jimmy could see that she had been crying. "What's wrong, Mom?" he asked her. Shirley looked at him and said, "I slapped that little brat, and they fired me for it." Between Shirley's crying and self-incriminations, Jimmy was finally able to piece together what had happened to cost his mother her job. Shirley was the head maid at a motel that was located at 29th and Farallon, just a few blocks from their home. The motel was owned by the Downtown Ramada Inn and was used as a hideaway for the rich and famous. Whenever a celebrity came to town, they would check into the Ramada Inn, then be shuttled to the small, nondescript motel. This kept them out of the prying eyes of the press and public. Shirley, as the head maid of the motel, was the only service worker permitted to enter and clean the celebrity rooms. She was also charged with acting as a gopher for them. If they needed something, Shirley would go for it. And it was in this role as gopher that Shirley had lost her temper and her job. Celebrities came to Topeka for a multitude of reasons. They might have a concert at the municipal auditorium or fairgrounds. They might be in town for a guest appearance on the local TV station to promote some TV show or movie they were in, or as a spokesperson for some product they were promoting. But most celebrities that stayed at the motel were there waiting for admission to the Miniker Foundation Clinic. Whether from psychological, drug, or alcohol problems, the motel served as a way station on their road to the clinic. Shirley had always shared stories of her interactions with the numerous celebrities she encountered with Jimmy and Patty. In most cases, her stories were positive, and she had found the celebrities open, friendly, polite, and approachable. Not so with the celebrity that had checked into the motel 3 days ago. He was a young boy, and he was a brat. His parents were nice enough, but he was uncontrollable, and that is why they were in Topeka. He was scheduled to be admitted to the clinic for behavioral modification. The boy was the featured singer and youngest member of 5 brothers who were the hottest musical group of the day. Yesterday, Shirley had told Jimmy, "He is the biggest prima donna I have ever seen. He acts as though the world owes him. He is the one bad apple, and he is spoiling the whole bunch. Once they check him into the clinic, I hope it is the 12th of never before I ever see him again. And that's a long, long time." The song references by Shirley had made Jimmy laugh, but what had happened today was no laughing matter. The boy's agent and parents had asked Shirley to keep an eye on him while they went to Miniker's to sign the final papers for his admission. They reminded her not to say anything about where they were, as the boy thought he was in Topeka for a concert performance at Forbes Air Base. Shirley assured the parents that she would not say anything and she would keep an eye on him. Shirley busied herself with cleaning his room while his parents and the agent were gone. The boy lay back on one of the two beds, playing with a transistor radio and complaining that there weren't any good radio stations in Topeka. Suddenly he said, "I want a candy bar." Shirley, who was busy cleaning the bathroom, said, "Okay, just a moment, please. Let me get done here and I will go get you one." This was not good enough for his highness, and he demanded, "Stop what you are doing and go get it for me now." Sighing, Shirley came out of the bathroom and asked, "What kind of candy bar do you want?" He shrugged, "I don't know. What's good?" Shirley said, "I like Mars bars and Snickers." He got up off the bed and approached her. "Okay, that will be good." Shirley managed her best customer service smile and said, "Which one, Mars or Snickers?" He shrugged. "Not my job to figure it out. That's your job." Shirley gritted her teeth. "Okay, I'll need some money." Sneering, he said, "Use your own money, bitch." Shirley slapped his face and lost her job. Shirley suffered from migraines and anxiety attacks, and she could feel both coming on. She asked Jimmy if he would fix dinner for his sister and himself so that she could just go to bed and forget about the day. Jimmy assured his mother that he would take care of things, and Shirley headed off to the bedroom. Shirley sat on the edge of her bed and asked Jimmy to bring her bottle of tranquilizers from the medicine cabinet. Jimmy retrieved the medicine, and opening the bottle, Jimmy took out one of her tranquilizers and handed it to his mother, along with a glass of water. Looking at the bottle in her son's hand, she thought, "What the hell? I'll take another one tonight. I just want to sleep right now." "Jimmy, please give me one more." She took the pill from her son and popped the two tranquilizers into her mouth. Taking a big drink of water, she handed the glass back to Jimmy. "Please put it up." Around 8 p.m., Jimmy was getting his sister ready for bed when he heard the phone ring. His mother kept the phone in her bedroom next to her bed. He heard her fumble for it, and in a slurred, sleepy voice, she said, "Hello?" There was a pause. "Jack? Oh, hi, Jack." Jack was Shirley's current boyfriend. "What?" Pause. "What?" Pause. "I'm okay, tired." Pause. "Got fired. Want to sleep." Pause. "What?" Pause. "Took my pills. Pause. "I don't know. Sleepy. Bye." Jimmy heard his mother hang up and did not think anything more about it. The next day was a school day, so after getting his sister to bed, Jimmy got ready for bed and lay down to read for a moment before going to sleep. Suddenly, the sound of sirens and red lights filled the small house. Jimmy jumped up out of bed as the front door was kicked open by a Shawnee County Sheriff's deputy. Everything past that point happened so fast that Jimmy had a problem understanding what was going on. When Jack had hung up from Shirley, he had called the sheriff's department to report that his girlfriend had taken an overdose of sleeping pills. The little house sat on the west side of Chunganunga Creek and was outside of the Topeka city limits, so the Shawnee County Sheriff's Department had responded. The children were rounded up by a deputy as the ambulance crew and two more sheriff's deputies were struggling to place Shirley on a stretcher. Though drowsy, Shirley was putting up a good fight. She did not know what was going on or why these strangers had broken into her house and were talking nonsense about an overdose. No one was listening to her, and she was feeling trapped and frustrated. "Please," she screamed. "What are you doing? My children! My children!" As they wheeled Shirley out of the living room, she saw Jimmy and Patty standing next to a deputy. "Jimmy, get my address book! My address book!" Jimmy looked around and spotted his mom's address book on top of the piano. He snagged it and handed it to her. Shirley grabbed it and, trying to focus, quickly flipped to a page where her brother's phone number was. "Here!" She shoved the book towards the deputy standing by the children. "Here!" she said again. The deputy stopped and the ambulance crew by the front door and took the book. "What's this?" he asked.
That's my brother's phone number. Carl. His name is Carl. Call him. He will get the children."
The deputy looked down at the book.
"Please call him," Shirley cried. Have him get my children. Please, promise."
The deputy reached out and put his hand on Shirley's shoulder. "You calm down now. It will be okay. You go to the hospital so they can tend to you. I'll call your brother and take the children over there myself." Shirley tried to focus on him.
Why are you doing this to me?"
The deputy smiled. "Your boyfriend was concerned because of the overdose of pills you took, and he called us to help you." Shirley screamed, "I didn't overdose! I didn't overdose! I didn't overdose!" She kept screaming over and over as they wheeled her out the door and to the waiting ambulance. After the ambulance pulled away, lights flashing and siren blaring, the deputy had Jimmy and Patty get dressed. He walked them to his waiting car. "Where are we going?" Jimmy asked. The deputy smiled as he placed the children in the back seat of his cruiser. "I'm taking you to some place you will be safe." As the deputy slid in behind the steering wheel, Jimmy said, "Sir, are we going to my uncle's house?" The deputy did not answer as they pulled out of the drive. He reached for his mic and keying it, said, "Unit 22 en route to juvenile detention center with two children. Boy 15, girl 9. ETA 10 minutes. Jimmy was scared. He had never been so scared in his life. He knew that juvie was. It was a place for child criminals, and he did not know why he and his sister had been brought here. The sheriff's deputy had lied to his mother. Instead of Jimmy and Patty going to their Uncle Carl's home, they were brought to the place where they lock up criminals. Jimmy was no criminal, neither was his sister. Why were they here? When they entered the facility, Patty was led away down a right corridor by a matron. Patty was crying and kept calling for their mother. "Mommy, Mommy," came her plaintive wail. The deputy put his hand on Jimmy's shoulder. "Your sister will be okay." Jimmy pulled away from him. "Where are they taking her, and why are we here?" he demanded. The deputy smiled. "Your sister is being taken to the girl's side, and you'll go to the boy's side." Jimmy was getting angry. "But why are we here? You told my mom you would take us to my uncle's. This is juvie. This is not my Uncle Carl's place." The deputy shrugged his shoulders, and he said, "Your mother is sick and cannot make good decisions. We will decide where you and your sister go, not her." Jimmy was led down the corridor by guard and the deputy to a pale green room. Within the room was a long table with several pieces of paper on it, a small sheet of glass, a tube that looked like it could hold toothpaste, and a miniature roller. Against one wall was a white screen with measurements and lines crossing its face. A camera was set up in front of the screen, and leaning against the tripod was a small board with letters and numbers on it. The deputy grabbed the clipboard off the wall, wrote something on it, and hung it back on the wall. "See you later, Alex. He's all yours," the deputy said as he left the room. Alex looked at Jimmy up and down, sizing him up. "Okay, kid," he said. "Don't give me no shit, and I won't give you no shit." Jimmy was confused. "I'm not giving you shit. I'm not giving anybody anything. I don't even know why I'm here." Alex walked around to the other side of the table. "You don't know why you're here?" Alex mocked him. "You don't know why you're here? You fucked up, asshole. That's why you're here." Jimmy could feel tears starting to form in his eyes. "I haven't done anything wrong," he choked out. "My mother." Alex cut him off. "A little late to be calm for your mommy now, dumbass. Should have thought about that before you fucked up." Jimmy didn't know what to say, so he just dropped his head and shut up, holding back his tears. He would not let Alex see him cry. Jimmy had to think. There had to be someone he could talk to. He decided to just go along with Alex, and maybe he could find someone later on who would listen to him and tell Jimmy why he and his sister had been taken to juvie. Alex squeezed a black paste from the tube onto the glass panel and started smoothing it out with the roller. "Ever been fingerprinted, kid?" Jimmy shook his head no. "Well, today is your lucky day, kid. First time for everything, and for punks like you, it probably won't be the last." Alex fingerprinted Jimmy and then took his mug shots. He then led Jimmy out of the door and down the hallway. Stopping in front of a heavy steel door, Alex produced a large key. Placing it in the slot on the door, Alex turned the key with a loud clanking sound as the door swung open. Jimmy looked inside the cell. On the floor was a vinyl-covered mattress on which rested a wool blanket and an uncovered blue ticking striped pillow. A single dim yellow light in a cage high in the ceiling illuminated the chamber. Alex shoved Jimmy into the room. "Take off your clothes and hand them to me. Leave your underwear on." Jimmy looked at Alex, who could read the question on why on the boy's face. "Because you won't need them. We'll wash your clothes, and we will give you some more clothes in the morning. Nobody in here is allowed to keep their own clothes. Clothes belong to everyone. No one owns anything in here, and you gave up that right when you got your punk ass thrown in here." Jimmy took off his clothes and handed them to Alex. As the cell door closed, Jimmy lay down on the cold vinyl mattress, pulling the wool blanket up over his face to block out the amber light. He cried himself to sleep. Jimmy was awakened by a kick to his butt. Startled awake, he looked up to see a different guard standing over him. The guard dropped a shirt, pants, and slippers on the floor in front of him. "Get dressed, breakfast," was all the guard said. Jimmy hurriedly got dressed in the clothes that smelled like too much bleach. "I think this shirt is too small," the guard snorted. "We don't have any tailors to do any fitting for you. Now follow me." Jimmy followed the guard out of the door and down the hallway. After breakfast, you will go to class and be there until lunch. After lunch, you will go back to class and stay there until dinner. After dinner, you will help clean the day room. After the day room is cleaned, you can watch TV until night, at which time you must return to your cell. If your attorney shows up or it is time for you to go to court, you will be pulled out of class. If you cause any trouble or start any fights with any of the other boys, we have punishments that will ensure that you do not do that again. We have no patience for tough guys in here. Any questions? Jimmy cleared his throat.
Yes, sir. Why are me and my sister in here? The deputy was supposed to take us to our uncle's house.
The guard came to a stop and turned to look at Jimmy. Jimmy was large for a 15-year-old, standing almost 6 feet tall and weighing in at 175 pounds. He was able to look the guard in the eye.
You don't know what your crime is? The guard queried.
I didn't commit a crime, and neither did my sister. My mother was taken to the hospital, and she asked the sheriff's deputy to take me and my sister to my uncle's house, and he brought us here.
The guard, whose name was John, studied Jimmy's face for a moment, as if trying to discern if he was kidding or making something up. John had heard every bullshit story from the delinquents that were brought into this prison for children, but this was something new.
Go have breakfast, John said. Follow the rules I gave you, and I will look into this.
Jimmy thanked John and entered the day room. Jimmy did as he was told, following the rules. John had laid down to the letter. He did not interact with the other boys, staying to himself. He wasn't here to make friends with these kids. Already hardened criminals at a young age, they were not people Jimmy cared to know. Jimmy kept a scowl on his face and avoided all eye contact. He was an avid reader and loved animals and watched every single animal show that came on TV, especially Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. How many times had he heard Marlon Perkins, Jim Fowler, and Stan Brock warn against looking a predator in the eye? To Jimmy, these boys were predators, so he reasoned that using his size, silence, and an unreadable demeanor would keep him safe, and he was correct. None of the other boys made any effort to approach Jimmy, and that was fine with him. Early in the day, Jimmy asked one of the guards, or counselors as he found out they were called, about his sister. He was told that it was none of his business and what was going on with her, and to get back to his studies. Jimmy waited patiently most of the day to hear from John, but the counselor had not returned to tell him anything. It was late in the day, and Jimmy was helping to clean up the day room when one of the counselors approached him and said, "Follow me." Jimmy set down the duster he had been using and followed the counselor out of the room. He could feel the eyes of the other boys on his back as he walked through the door. Jimmy was led into an austere room. The walls were painted a pale green. On the wall to his left was a large mirror taking up most of the wall. Jimmy had seen this type of mirror before and knew it was a two-way mirror. A heavy gray metal desk occupied the center of the room with a chair on either side of it. The chair closest to Jimmy was empty. The chair on the other side of the desk facing the door was not. The chair was occupied by a woman that was just as austere as the room. She was reading through a file folder in front of her. Without looking up from the folder, she instructed Jimmy to sit down and the counselor to leave. Closing the folder, she looked up at Jimmy as she removed her reading glasses.
"My name is Miss Evans. I have been appointed by the court to be your mother's protective guardian. I'm also the protective guardian of you and your sister."
She drew her tight little mouth into a semblance of a smile that reminded Jimmy of the Dr. Seuss character, the Grinch. Jimmy studied her for a moment as she continued.
"I need to ask you a few questions."
Jimmy cut her off. "You're a social worker." It was a statement, not a question.
"Excuse me?"
Miss Evans asked. "You are a social worker." Miss Evans cleared her throat.
"Yes, I am. Now let's get through those questions."
Jimmy's mother hated social workers, hated them with a passion. Shirley had been forced to deal with them for years because of her need for help from Aid for Families with Dependent Children, welfare. Shirley called social workers bureaucratic morons. Shirley had, in her opinions, and this was one she was very vocal on,
"They are poor little rich girls whose mommy and daddy send them to college, get a degree to contribute something to the world. They have no idea what it is not to have, to be poor. The only social they know is the parties at their sororities, and the only work they have ever done is to order a servant to lift a silver spoon to their mouth. They are nothing more than debutantes waiting for the golf stud at the local country club to take them away from the unwashed masses."
"Has your mother ever physically abused you?"
Though the answer to that question would be yes, Jimmy ignored it and asked his own question. "Where's my mother?" Miss Evans cleared her throat again.
"Now, Jimmy, you need to..."
He cut her off. "I said, where's my mother?" Miss Evans fidgeted in her chair.
"Your mother is fine. She's in the hospital."
Jimmy fixed her with a hard stare. "Why?" Miss Evans again cleared her throat.
"That is unimportant right now."
Jimmy said it again. "Why?" Miss Evans was growing visibly more uncomfortable. She was not used to a child being this direct with her. She had always been able to intimidate anyone she spoke with, especially children. This child was having no part of her game. She had to get the control back, so she decided to quickly answer his questions, then get answers to her own.
Your mother took an overdose of sleeping pills and tried to commit suicide. She was taken to the Santa Fe Hospital to have her stomach pumped and for observation. The courts have decided, based on your mother's previous mental history, to make her a ward of the state for her protection and the protection of you and your sister.
Miss Evans smiled with satisfaction. There, that should shut the little brat up.
Now, let's get back to those questions.
Jimmy sat back in his chair and folded his arms over his chest. So that is what this is about. They think Mom tried to kill herself because she lost her job.
Has your mother ever physically abused you?
Jimmy leaned forward, rested his hands on the table, folded them. He asked, did you read her pill bottle?
Miss Evans looked at him. What?
Jimmy repeated his question. Did you read her pill bottle?
Miss Evans cleared her throat. No, that's not relevant.
Jimmy shook his head. No, it is relevant. Mom has been on the same tranquilizers, not sleeping pills, tranquilizers, for years. My mother suffers from migraines and anxiety. I have read the bottle, and I know what it says. Miss Evans tried again to gain control.
This has nothing to do,
but Jimmy cut her off. It has everything to do with everything. The dosage on the bottle is 1 to 2 tablets as needed, not to exceed 4 tablets a day. My mother very seldom takes more than 1 tablet at a time, but sometimes, just like yesterday, when she is really upset and just wants to sleep, she will take 2 tablets. Miss Evans did not like that this kid was dominating the conversation, and she wasn't going to tolerate it any longer.
She took more than 2 tablets.
Jimmy sat back in the chair again.
Really?
Did she? How would you know?
Were you there?
Miss Evans cleared her throat.
No, but...
Jimmy laughed, mocking her.
No, but...
I was there. I got a glass of water for her, and I took the 2 pills out of the bottle and handed them to her. I saw her take them, and I took the pill bottle back to the medicine cabinet in the bathroom. You have to walk through my bedroom to get to the bathroom. Mom's room is at the back of the house, and if she had got up and walked to the medicine cabinet, I would have known it. She went to sleep, and Jack woke her up less than an hour later. She was groggy. You would be, too, if you had just taken 2 tranquilizers and gone to bed. What you people did was wrong, from not taking my mother to the hospital to bringing me and my sister here. No wonder my mom hates social workers. Miss Evans became visibly flustered, and Jimmy heard a laugh come from the other side of the mirror. You need to let me, my mom, and sister go home and leave us alone. Miss Evans again cleared her throat. She had never had anyone talk to her like that. This child was supposed to be meek, mild, and intimidated. She had to gain back control, and she had a job to do. He's a child. He has no idea what he's talking about.
I'm afraid it is not that easy. Now let's get back to these questions.
Jimmy cleared his throat, imitating the now flustered Miss Evans.
We will go before a judge.
Miss Evans nodded her head.
The judge will go off my recommendation, but yes, he will want to talk with you and your sister.
Jimmy smiled. Then I have nothing else to say to you, Miss Evans. I'll say to the judge, I'm sure he'd like to know the truth and how me and my sister have been treated like common criminals in here instead of being taken to my uncle's house like the deputy promised my mother he would do. Miss Evans suddenly realized what he meant. If this brat told the judge what he had just told her about his mother only taking the recommended dosage of her pills, she would be branded a fool and might even lose her job. She was the one who had ordered the children to the detention center, and she was the one who would be held responsible for not sending the children to their relatives' home. She had to put the fear of God in this kid, and she had to do it now. Standing up from her chair and leaning forward on the table in her best intimidating manner, she yelled,
"Listen, you little bastard!"
Jimmy stood up, looked her in the eye for just a moment, and walked over to the mirror. "I have nothing else to say to her," he said to his own reflection. The same counselor that had led him to the austere room led him out of it and back down the corridor to the cell Jimmy had occupied the night before. Jimmy stripped and handed the ill-fitting clothes to the counselor. Lying down on the mattress, Jimmy covered himself up with a wool blanket but did not fall immediately asleep. He lay on his back, looking up at the yellow light, thinking. At some point, a fitful sleep overtook him. Jimmy did not know how long he'd been asleep. All he knew was that someone was roughly shaking him awake.
"Come on, kid, get up. I said get up."
Jimmy rubbed his eyes and looked up. Counselor Alex was standing above him.
"Here, put your clothes on."
Alex dropped Jimmy's green denim jeans and tie-dye shirt on the floor along with his kid tennis shoes. Jimmy's jeans had little white spots all over them that had not been there when they were taken from him, and they smelled like bleach. Everything in this place smelled like bleach. Jimmy's tie-dyed cotton t-shirt seemed to have shrunk as he pulled it over his head. "Where are we going?" Jimmy asked.
"Just hurry it up, asshole. Time to go."
Alex grabbed Jimmy by the arm and lifted him up off the floor as he was tying his last shoe. Alex shoved Jimmy out into the corridor and led him up the hallway. Though there were no windows in the hallway, Jimmy could tell that it was still dark outside. He would never have been able to explain to you how he knew it was still dark outside. He just knew. Up ahead in the corridor, a clock near the ceiling jutted out from the wall. Though its stark white face, which was encased in a round steel gray casing, shone like a floating snowball in the hallway, it was difficult to make out the position of the hands in the dimly lit corridor. A few more steps closer, and Jimmy strained his eyes to see, made out the time, 5:07. 5 o'clock in the morning? Why did this jerk-off wake me at 5 o'clock in the morning? At the end of the corridor, there were two heavy steel doors side by side. Each door had a small, narrow window in it. The windows were double-paned, and between the panes of glass was a piece of chicken wire. Now, why on earth, he thought, would there need to be a security window in an opening no bigger than 6 by 12 inches? I want to see the skinny little fuck that could squeeze through that. For the briefest of moments, Jimmy had found something amusing in this dark and terrible situation he had found himself in. Alex unlocked the door with his oversized key. Opening it up, he stepped to one side and with a smile said, "Please, sir, after you." Jimmy looked at him more frightened by his sudden change in Alex's demeanor than anything else in this hateful counselor had done to him thus far. Jimmy took a hesitant step forward and peered into the lobby of the juvenile detention center. Standing in front of the large security desk were two figures, his mother and his sister. His mother had been filling out some kind of form attached to a clipboard when he came through the door. Patty saw him first and, hugging on her mother's skirt, said, "Mommy, it's Jimmy!" He ran to them and hugged them both in turn. "Jimmy, are you okay?" Shirley asked. But before Jimmy could answer, Alex walked up smiling.
"Mrs. Stewart, I just want you to know what a fine boy you have here. We are so happy that we had the pleasure of looking after and keeping your children safe for you."
Alex offered his right hand to Shirley, but just before she made contact with it, she spat in his face. "Fuck you, motherfucker! Come on, children, let's go." Shirley took both of her children by the hands and led them through the big glass doors that separate the gray and pale green interior of the building from the fresh air of the exterior. Shirley stopped at the door and, without turning around, said, "Are you going to buzz us out, bitch, or do I have to do it myself?" The matron behind the big desk pressed the button. With a loud buzzing sound and a click of the door unlocked, and Shirley led her children out of the detention center. Once in the car and heading safely home, Jimmy said, "That guy treated me like shit." Shirley nodded her head. "I know, that's why I refused to shake his hand and spat on him." Jimmy looked at his mother. "But how did you know?" His mother smiled. "A mother always knows." On the trip home, the children relayed to their mother all that had happened. Shirley listened to their stories attentively until Jimmy told her his confrontation with Miss Evans. Shirley nodded her head and said, "Ah, that explains it." Jimmy gave her a quizzical look. "Explains what, Mom?" Shirley said, "Wait till we get home and get something to eat, and I will tell you guys everything." Shirley had fried up some eggs and fixed toast and jam for them all. They ate, and after putting their dishes in the sink, Shirley poured herself a cup of coffee and sat down in her favorite chair in the living room. The children sat on the couch. "When the ambulance took me away," Shirley began, "I heard the driver talking into his microphone and saying that it was an attempted suicide. I started protesting, but they wouldn't listen." She looked at the children. "You know I didn't try to kill myself, right?" Patty nodded her head, and Jimmy said, "I know, Mom. I'm the one who handed you the pills. I told Miss Evans that." Shirley smiled and continued. "The attendant that was saying next to my gurney, take my blood pressure, said that Jack and the deputy both told them I had tried to kill myself with an overdose of pills, and that is what they had to go by. I said, but I did an overdose. Don't my word mean anything? The guy said my word meant nothing because I was the attempted suicide and I would say anything. Two witnesses had said I tried to kill myself, and now they had to follow their orders." Shirley took a sip of her coffee and continued her story. "They took me to Santa Fe Hospital and put me into the crazy ward." Jimmy interrupted her. "The crazy ward?" Shirley nodded. "Yeah, the crazy ward, where they put people that are crazy like me." Shirley crossed her eyes, stuck out her tongue, and making the children laugh, she sighed. "Anyway, they put a long tube down my throat and into my stomach and pumped it out." Patty said, "Yuck, Mommy, that's nasty." Shirley said, "Yes, it is." She took another sip of her coffee. "They locked me up in a room where they put these leather cuffs on my arms that were tied to the railing of the bed so that I wouldn't hurt myself. I laid there for a long time." Shirley's eyes moistened. "I thought you children were safe with Carl. I didn't know." Jimmy looked at his mother. "That's all right, Mom. It's not your fault." Patty left the couch and climbed onto her mother's lap. At 9 years old, Patty was starting to be too big to sit on mother's lap any longer, but Shirley let her. Patty laid her head on Shirley's shoulder, and she continued her story. A psychiatrist came in and asked me a whole bunch of asinine questions. I told him several times I did not try to kill myself, and all the asswipe would say is, "We know what's best for you." At one point, I asked him what had pumped out of my stomach, and he had said not much of anything. I said, "So what does that tell you, moron?" He said that it didn't prove anything, that I could have digested the pills into my system by the time they got to me. I said, "Then I would be dead now, and I would not have to listen to your bullshit, right?" This made Jimmy and Patty laugh. Around noon yesterday, that Evans whore came into my room and informed me that she was my court-appointed guardian. That is when I found out that I had happened to you and your sister. I told her to take you guys out of there and over to Carl's house. She told me that I no longer made decisions for you two or myself, as I wasn't responsible enough to care for myself, let alone my children. She informed me that she would be taking care of all my decision-making from here on out, and that she would see to it that you children would be put into a decent and loving home. When I asked her what that meant, she said that she was placing you two in the foster care program. Shirley looked at the floor. I exploded. Jimmy had seen his mother lose her temper before. He had been on the receiving end of it several times, suffering abuse at her hands. She would often swing a broom at him when she was in one of her rages. She had even broken his ankle once, when he was 11 years old, as she had been beating him with the broom. He had lied at the hospital and said he had fallen off the front porch stairs, but he never thought that they believed him. Of course, Shirley was always sorry afterwards, and Jimmy always forgave her. He could only imagine what had happened when his mother lost her temper with the snooty Miss Evans. "If I hadn't been tied down, I would have ripped her apart," Shirley said, gritting her teeth. Jimmy had no doubt that his mother would have. For all her faults, the one thing Shirley always was, protective of her children. Many people had found it their bad mistake to be on the shit end of the stick when it came to this mama lion protecting her cubs. "I started screaming at the whore, giving her a piece of my mind when they came in, held me down, and gave me a shot that put me to sleep. I slept until almost 3 o'clock in the morning, when Evans' whore showed back up in my room with some papers for me to sign." "What papers, Mom?" Jimmy asked. Shirley took a big drink of her now lukewarm coffee and heaved a heavy sigh. "Basically, it is my agreement that Evans' whore is my and you children's legal guardian for the next 365 days. I have to go to outpatient treatment at the Family Service Clinic to talk to the therapist every Thursday for the next year. If I fail to make even one appointment or try to kill myself again, I will be committed to the state hospital for an indefinite period of time, and you children will go to foster care. I will be reevaluated after 1 year to see if I am responsible enough to be your mother again instead of the Evans whore. Oh, yeah, and I almost forgot. You have to see a therapist too, Jimmy." Jimmy was puzzled. "Why?" Shirley let out a small laugh. "You apparently scared the shit out of the Evans whore when you had that confrontation with her. All she said to me was, 'I have determined that after my interview with your son that he is antisocial behavior and aggressive tendencies. I have ordered therapy for him also. So now we both have to go because you stood up to her.'" Shirley put Patty off her lap and stood up. "Come here," she said to Jimmy. Jimmy left the couch and crossed over to his mother, and she gave him a hug and kiss on the cheek. "Thank you, son, for what you said to Evans' whore. It kept me from being committed and you children from being taken away from me. I love you." Jimmy gave his mother a kiss on the cheek and said, "I love you too, Mom." Late that afternoon, a knock came on the front door. Jimmy went to the door and, opening up, found Jack standing there.
"Hey, Jimbo, how's it going?" he said cheerfully.
Shirley came up behind Jimmy, shoved him to one side, and slammed the door in Jack's face. That was the last time they ever saw Jack. Shirley had found a job rather quickly after the motel incident. A new discount store called Woka was opening up on Fairlawn Plaza, and they were looking for experienced retail workers, and she fit the bill. The manager was younger than Shirley had been, and very understanding of her situation when she explained that her and her son had to attend therapy every Thursday. He arranged her schedule so that she had Thursdays and Sundays off. Shirley did not know how she would feel about a split schedule, but it was better than losing her children. Shirley fit right into the fast-paced retail environment of the store, and soon the manager had her working the customer service desk full-time. Shirley would come home from work and tell the children stories of what had happened to her that day. One day, Shirley came home from work laughing and told Jimmy that she had not been able to stop laughing all day. When Jimmy asked why, she said, "You know that fruit that I told you about that I work with?" Jimmy said, "The queer guy?" Shirley laughed, "Yeah, him.
Well, he came into work today and was complaining that his ass hurt because the guy he had went out with last night was too big. He said he was ripped and he had to wear a pad because of the bleeding. Jimmy screwed up his face. That's gross, Mom. Shirley chuckled. Oh, wait, it gets better. I finally got tired of hearing him talk about it and reached into my purse and offered him one of my tampons. I told him that this was less bulky than a pad and he was used to having things shoved up his ass, so this shouldn't bother him. Shirley broke out in peal laughter. He hasn't talked to me since. Shirley liked working at Oracle, not only because she enjoyed the work, but because she got discounts on things she purchased, like clothes for the children. It had been years since Shirley had been able to buy the children new clothes. Most of the children's wardrobe had come from the Salvation Army and other secondhand stores. But now Shirley was able to buy the children new clothes, and that made her extremely happy. Shirley and Jimmy kept their therapy appointments religiously, going to Family Guidance Counseling Services at 21st and Clay Streets every Thursday. Shirley would go off with her therapist, and Jimmy would go off with his. Jimmy did not understand the reason for the meetings with his therapist. They seemed useless. He would go in, talk about what happened at school or home the previous week, answer a few inane questions, and then sit in the waiting room reading magazines and waiting for his mother to finish her appointment. Jimmy didn't want to go, but he knew he had to. Shirley and Jimmy had been diligent in doing what they had to do to keep the Evans whore from descending on their family like a starving harpy to feed on their bones. Yes, they had been diligent about their responsibility all the way up until May 25th of 1972. Well, that concludes this episode of the Rubber Biscuit Roadshow. Tune in next week when we find out that, Houston, we have a problem. Until then, may God bless and keep you and yours. Later, Gators. Bye-bye now. Visit the Rubber Biscuit Roadshow online at www.rubberbiscuit.com. That's www.rubberbiscuit.com. The Rubber Biscuit Roadshow is produced by Tatman Productions, LLC. All parts of this program are copyrighted, all rights reserved. No parts may be published, reproduced, or used without the written express permission of Tatman Productions, LLC.